abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
And welcome, everybody, on this October 10th, 2013. Neoconservatives are the topic of discussion today. Who are they? Who are the neocons? Where do they come from? What do they believe? What are they up to? And what are they conniving to do in the future? We'll ask our guest Dan McCarthy, editor of the American Conservative magazine, in just a minute. But first, a couple of program notes here. To my great delight, I woke up the other day and discovered that this program in iTunes, in the category News and Politics, which is where we've been placed, are the number 5 podcast on iTunes as of a day or so ago. Well, that was a real surprise, to put it mildly. So thank you. Thanks for subscribing. And if you haven't subscribed, why don't you do that? Because wouldn't that be great to keep this momentum going? That was a real surprise. Thank you guys very much for the support. Also, don't forget, you're just one day away from my giveaway offer, Disappearing Forever. And that is my book, Rollback, which is my sort of book to help you win debates. It is the why everything's a scam, everything should be abolished from, yes, Obamacare, obviously, but then to the not-so-obvious things for some people, like the Fed, the military-industrial complex, and all down the line, chapter after chapter, that's what Rollback is all about, equipping you with some good material you can use against your unsuspecting friends. So you can get a free copy of that by joining my libertyclassroom.com by tomorrow. By the end of October 11th, 2013, I will never acknowledge this offer again. What are you talking about? I would never give away a precious, signed, personalized copy of Rollback? Why, that's like a gold coin, for heaven's sake. All right, so that's libertyclassroom.com. Make sure and check that out. Dan McCarthy's a guy I've known for, I guess, probably, it's got to be 10 years, I would say, at least. Maybe it's longer. But he is the editor of the American Conservative magazine, where, in the interest of full disclosure, I am a contributing editor. The website is theamericanconservative.com. And I think it's well worth reading, and I suspect after our chat with Dan, you'll agree with me. Dan McCarthy, thanks so much for spending some time with me today.
Well, thank you for having me on, Tom.
All right, so I want to do a little bit, as I said in the opening, a little bit of past, present, and maybe mostly future. But by past, what I mean is, I think people use the term neoconservative, or they hear neocon a lot, and maybe it might even be overused to some degree, that everybody you dislike is a neocon, although it seems to be the truth, actually. But can you maybe just start off, before we talk about the present situation of the neocons, where they're likely to go in the future, or how they're going to morph in the future, or whatever, who are these people? I mean, is there a specific set of beliefs that they have, or do they come from a particular tradition, or like who the heck are they?
Well, that's right. There's kind of a genealogy of them on the one hand, and there's also a few sort of attitudes that are sometimes associated with specific policies that tend to distinguish them. So they're almost always extremely hawkish. That's a defining characteristic, and while there are other hawkish right-wingers, the neocons are sort of unusual in that respect. In terms of their genealogy, they're interesting because most of their origins are on the left. In some cases, actually, a few of the key ones, such as Irving Kristol and Joshua Moravchik, had started out as members of the Young People's Socialist League at City College in New York. But others had never actually had a sort of socialist or Trotskyist background, but they had been on the left sort of during the 1960s. And it's over the course of really the last 40 years or so that they've come to identify themselves more as Republicans and more as people on the right.
Now, today, right now, are the neocons in are they still sort of in the saddle? Have they had, do you feel like they've had any setbacks? Was the Syria thing a setback, or is that just something minor that, was that an aberration that we're going to forget about a year from now?
I think Syria was a disappointment to them more than a setback. The neocons' power is behind the scenes. It lies in the institutions they control, the sort of philanthropies and fundraising tools that they have, and also their media presence. So the Syria, our refusal to go to war in Syria didn't deprive the neocons of any of those weapons. But it did disappoint them because they, as I say, tend to be very, very hawkish. They love the idea of empire in the abstract as much as they are committed to specific policies, either for the U.S. or for Israel.
But when we try to nail down, though, who today is a neocon, I mean, there are some neocons who, like Bill Kristol, for example, who clearly do not believe in limited government in any reasonable sense of that term. But then on the other hand, you get a guy like Mark Levin, and those of you listening to this program know I'm by no means a particular fan of Mark Levin, and he's had choice words for me, and I've had arguments for him, and he's just had choice words for me. So that's it's been a little bit lopsided. But the thing is that he does, to some degree, except on foreign policy, of course, which is what I think makes some people call him a neocon, he does seem to believe in limited government in a lot of ways. So are all these people, is Fred Barnes a neocon and John McCain and Mark Levin, even though they can't stand each other? Like John McCain and Mark Levin don't like each other. How do we make sense of all this? Are they all neocons?
Well, it gets hard to distinguish because the neocons have been so influential on the right in general, both the Republican Party, talk radio, institutions, magazines, etc., that even things that don't start out as being explicitly neoconservative wind up having a certain neoconservative tendency or coloration to them. So Mark Levin might not actually be a neocon per se, but he's somebody who's clearly very influenced them, especially influenced by them in his foreign policy. The neocons themselves, their domestic policy is, it takes a back seat to their hawkishness, especially today. Their domestic policy, their preference tends to be rather moderate. They are not enemies of big government. They're not enemies, really, of almost any kind of government power in principle. But in practice, they sometimes, favor more or less degrees of particular programs. So it's very hard to define them in terms of domestic policy. But on foreign policy, they tend to be very hawkish, and they tend to have a sense of America as being the little kid who's being bullied on the block, which is a very strange view because, of course, America is by far the most powerful country in the world. But that really is, I think, one of the defining neoconservative attitudes towards world affairs.
Did you see that article maybe a month or two ago in the Washington Times in which Newt Gingrich now is revealed to supposedly be having second thoughts about some of the neoconservative foreign policy adventures simply on pragmatic grounds that they haven't had the results that were hoped for and in some cases have had just downright counterproductive results? Is that a case of, I guess we can't really know the man's soul, right? We can't know, is this genuine soul searching? Or is this the fact that the Rand Paul bandwagon seems to be growing substantially and Gingrich is putting his finger in the wind to see which way it's blowing? Like, how did you take that?
Well, I had independently heard that Gingrich was having those kinds of second thoughts. And my own very brief encounters with Gingrich have shown me that, he is someone who reads books and who does try to think. His, predispositions are not reliable as far as I'm concerned. And certainly, his policies in general have been very, very detrimental, his policy preferences. But I think he actually realizes both that the Republican Party has been taken to a very dangerous and counterproductive place by neoconservatives in terms of the foreign policy they've imposed on it. And I think he simply wants an escape, and he's willing to look at whatever options might be open to him. And I think a lot of other Republicans feel the same way. They're not committed to one particular vision of foreign policy or another. They simply realize that what we've seen in the last decade has been disastrous for them on a purely practical level.
Well, somebody like Gingrich or Kristol, whom we've already mentioned, both of these guys, and we think of some of the names we associate with neoconservatism, they have one thing in common today, and that is they're over age 60, so many of them. So there's a generational issue at work here as well. So I think some of us who followed Ron Paul very closely, we kind of are under the impression that the young people are the Ron Paulians overwhelmingly, but yet surely there are young neocons. I mean, I went to CPAC for several years, and I didn't think they existed, and yet there they are. I didn't think there were people who would drop what they were doing so they could go watch just a video screen of a Mitt Romney speech, and yet there were such people. So, I mean, is there strength among young people in neoconservatism? And if so, like, where's that coming from? What are the institutions
the
that are forming
that
it?
They're not particularly strong with young people, although your experience at CPAC shows that there are people who, just for purely sort of political tribal reasons, identify with the Republican Party so strongly that they'll have, you know, a kind of admiration for someone like Mitt Romney, a figure who, you know, otherwise would generate no enthusiasm whatsoever. That's kind of a partisan Pavlovian reflex. And the neocons, because they exert so much influence on the Republican Party and the conservative movement, they're able to get some young people sort of by proxy through that mechanism. But in terms of, you know, the kind of young people who will shape the future, the leaders, the thinkers, the writers, the people who, you know, are most energetic about getting things done, it seems to me that the neocons are very weak there and that their philosophy is not gaining converts. But that's not to say that there's no one. I mean, they do have outlets such as the Washington Free Beacon, for example, a website with a great many young people working for it. And that's a website that was actually started by William Kristol's son-in-law. So the neocons do have a next generation, but it doesn't seem to be a generation that has the kind of intellectual resources or intellectual capital that the forefathers had.
Right. I mean, you can imagine reading something by Irving Kristol, let's say, and not thinking right away, this is the most preposterous thing I've ever read. But yet I find when I do come across young neocons, I don't know whether in Human Events or wherever they manage to get published, I mean, it could just be my own prejudices, but I'm distinctly unimpressed. They don't seem to be particularly widely read. They don't seem to aspire to be widely read. And it's almost as if they are people who aspire simply to be part of the machine, because the machine certainly doesn't reward people who are widely read. I don't see that in the American political establishment. Well, let me throw out a specific name to you, and I want to get your immediate response, like word association or something here. The name is
okay.
Ted Cruz. Tell me what you think about Ted Cruz.
Well, I think Ted Cruz is the bridge or the linchpin that can link neoconservatism with you know, the grassroots Tea Party, and even with, you know, a certain kind of libertarianism that may want to project onto Republican politicians something that isn't there. So Cruz, I don't know, you know, the man personally. I don't know where he's coming from necessarily. But I do know that he hasn't really done anything that has broken the mold for Republican thinking about any issue, let alone something like national security or foreign policy, the way that, you know, Ron Paul certainly did and Rand Paul has as well, or for that matter, Justin Amash in the House of Representatives. So Cruz is someone who seems to take the existing Republican set of attitudes and amplify them. And he amplifies them and he pitches them in a very articulate way, which I think is appealing to young people and to voters all across the country. But I don't see that the message itself is all that different from what we were getting during the Bush era.
Well, I thought right at the beginning when it was we had that confirmation dispute over, now I'm blanking on the name.
Oh, Chuck Hagel.
Chuck Hagel, right. When that dispute was going on, I thought he conducted himself like a propagandist, and I thought, well, I've been completely vindicated, because from the beginning I thought, there's no way this guy can be a foreign policy non-interventionist and have endorsed Rick Perry for president, people. You know, I couldn't understand the enthusiasm for this guy among so many people, but yet you typically see him lumped in with people say, well, the great people we have in the Senate are Mike Lee and Ted Cruz and Rand Paul. Now, so what do you think about that troika? Do you think there's something to that, that they are some kind of a block? And so, if so, how does Rand Paul fit into that block?
Well, they are and they aren't a block. I mean, they've all been elected fairly recently, since 2010, and they all are willing to fight the growth of government. And they've supported one another in various filibusters, and, you know, so I do think there is a linkage there. But I think each of them also has a distinct sort of a point of departure with their philosophy. With Rand Paul, I think it's very clearly a very strong element of his father's philosophy, and also a practical element that's also reexamining thinkers like George Kennan, for example, on foreign policy. So Rand Paul is someone who's very creative, and he takes a libertarian base and he turns it into something new and something that may have very good prospects in the future. Ted Cruz, I think, again, he's much more of a conventional Republican in the mold that we've seen in the past. I think he's someone who may be comparable to Jim DeMint, for example. So he may be very strong when it comes to limited government issues, But I have, you know, doubts about him when it comes to the more sort of difficult matters that Republicans tend to shy away from having any kind of anti-neocon views on, especially when it comes to the national security state or warfare. But even there, I should point out that, I mean, Cruz did say during the Hagel nomination hearings, where Hagel was basically being attacked because Hagel had been, I mean, Hagel had actually voted for the Iraq War in 2003, but he didn't support the surge in 2006. And people, you know, on the Republican hawkish right thought that Hagel was a dove, that he wasn't sufficiently pro-militaristic. And so that was the main contention in the Hagel hearings. And Cruz joined in on the criticisms of Hagel. But even then, Cruz did back off a little bit and say that he thought of himself as being sort of less aggressive in terms of his foreign policy than some of his other colleagues who were criticizing Hagel. So even Cruz is aware that this is not something that he wants to embrace wholeheartedly. He's not John McCain. But I do have doubts about him. And then I think Mike Lee is yet another thing, because he's clearly someone who comes from a constitutionalist conservative background that is not necessarily as doesn't have the libertarian theory that I think is behind some of Rand Paul's thinking, but clearly does have its own sort of serious basis as well. And Mike Lee's been doing a lot of work trying to craft a pro-family policy with tax cuts, for example, that can be melded together with constitutionalist conservatism and views of limited government. So I think each of those three individuals is actually very interesting and very distinct from the others, even though they wind up cooperating quite a lot.
Dan, I'm going to read you something. I want you to comment on it. I want you to expand on it. The conservative movement, as we've known it until now, is dying. It has powerful money-making scams, but no brain, no direction, and very little relevance to the economic, strategic, and cultural questions that matter today. Well, I'll preserve the anonymity of the author of this quotation, unless you'd like to spill the beans here. But say more about that, because I find that intriguing.
Well, that was something I wrote for the listener's benefit to Tom, earlier this afternoon.
Right. So I didn't know for sure if I was supposed to quote that.
Oh no, I'm happy to own up to it.
All right.
I've said similar things, in public. The conservative movement as it exists now is something that was developed during the Cold War, really to push a more military approach to the Cold War. And it has other elements. It has, social conservatives and others who have, clearly different priorities. But the whole infrastructure, the whole backbone and central hub is something that was built to address a certain set of conditions that existed during the Cold War, and not only during, the height of the Cold War, during its early days, but even during the later part, because what you see is that after Vietnam and after Nixon went to China, a lot of people on the right and also people who were sort of proto-neocons in the Democratic Party, they became very alarmed at what they saw as, detente and a general sort of demilitarization of the Cold War. So you had this new sort of alignment of hawks that started to cluster and roost in the old conservative movement from the Cold War, and that gave it a new lease on life. And that lease on life was then renewed yet again in 2001 when you had the 9/11 attacks. So this entity has been around in one form or another for about 60 years. But at this point, I think it's outlived its usefulness. It's something that can still generate a lot of television viewers and talk radio listeners, and it gets a lot of donor dollars because there's a perfected formula for going after sort of middle-aged and elderly white Americans and getting their money and getting their attention. But in terms of addressing what Americans under the age of 40 or so are most concerned about, I just don't see it. I mean, you don't see this conservative movement ahead of the curve when it comes to questions like, what do we think about the Federal Reserve? What do we think about America's role in the world if we don't want to be an empire, which Americans clearly do not want to be? I mean, they've voiced that concern in several elections in the past 5 years. So the conservative movement just doesn't address these questions. Instead, it's still fighting as if, the question is whether we're going to elect Ronald Reagan in 1980,
yeah,
and whether or not our stance towards, the Soviet Union is hard enough.
So that naturally leads to the question about the conservative movement and about neoconservatism in particular. They've got to change in some way, and they won't change in substance. If you elect them, they're still going to do the same things that you don't want anyone to do. But they have to portray themselves differently, given that their demographic is dying. In fact, even when you looked at the demographic, this is obviously a very, very rough estimate, but somebody found an interesting statistic about the demographics of those people who like Ron Paul on Facebook and those who like Rand Paul. And the Rand Paul likers are much older. And I suspect that that's going to be all the more true for people who are just out and out neocons. So what are they, how do you anticipate they're going to try to adjust to what is clearly a changing electorate? How do they do that? They're not just going to go down with the ship. They power is the most important thing in the world to them. How do they change in a way that doesn't compromise what they really want to do, but sort of puts a different gloss on it, maybe?
Well, they've done it before. In the 1980s and the 1990s, and really into the George W. Bush administration, neocons who started off being rather skeptical or critical of social conservatism, or you know, wanted to keep it at arm's length. They considered it somewhat uncouth. They became closer and closer to the religious right, basically. They found a way to build bridges. And at this point, you know, in terms of social policy, the neocons and the religious right are more or less indistinguishable. There are some exceptions. Someone like John Podoretz, for example, at a commentary, has a more progressive view of various social policies than many of the other neocons. But the neocons keep most of that pretty quiet, and they work very closely now with a lot of religious right leaders. I think their next step is to try to build similar bridges with the Tea Party and with certain kinds of libertarians. Again, what the neocons are most interested in is this kind of Manichaean worldview, this clash of good and evil to be fought by actual arms by the United States in the world. And, you know, they're perfectly willing to adjust their domestic policy on whatever issue it might be if that's necessary in order to gain power and to gain the sort of to perform the ritual, if it were, as it were, in terms of, you know, fighting the last battle of good and evil in the world.
Now, you know, Dan, this may be a heresy among some libertarians, but I have a lot of sympathy for conservatism, and in questions that are not directly political, I still think of myself as being a conservative. I don't use the word just because it brings up all these unfortunate associations. I don't want people to think I'm Ted Cruz or any of those sorts of people. And when I try to explain to people, look, there used to be a more humane, more intellectual, more civilized conservatism, people don't believe me because it looks like there are only like five or six such people. But what you're doing over at the American Conservative magazine is basically helping to buttress my case so I don't seem so implausible when I claim that there is a conservatism other than Rush Limbaugh. So why don't you take the closing 1 or 2 minutes just to explain to people what the mission is that you guys are up to over at the American Conservative magazine.
Yeah, the American Conservative, it's both a print magazine and also a website. The URL is theamericanconservative.com. We started back in 2002 really to show that there was another side of conservatism, not just what George W. Bush was pushing. George W. Bush, of course, favored the Iraq War. He was, you know, the driving force of that. And the American conservative basically said, this is completely wrong. This is wrong not only on, you know, a moral level. This is not only wrong on a strategic level. It's even wrong in terms of what conservatives actually stand for. And conservatism, as, you know, we understand it, and as, in fact, it was historically understood before you had this kind of movement that was fighting the Cold War, the historic conservatism has more of a Burkean element to it. It's thoughtful. It doesn't like sudden change. It's very skeptical of any kind of ideology that wants to transform the actual lives of people to fit some sort of ideal pattern. And that's true across the board. I mean, that's true whether it's communists trying to do it or whether it's you know, neoconservatives or anyone else. So conservatism, I think, has this depth and this sense of you know, sort of taking things very cautiously and judiciously that gets totally lost in, you know, so many other walks of life today. And the American conservative tries to bring that back. And we certainly believe very strongly in federalism. We believe very strongly in localism. Very much we are about, you know, this idea that if self-government means anything at all, it means self-government within, you know, a constrained context. It doesn't mean, you know, some sort of being one vote out of 300 million in a continental power. So, you know, it's not something that can be distilled into a soundbite, because it really is about taking so many of these ideological assumptions that people have been programmed to believe and deconstructing them and looking more seriously at what, you know, our actual lives and our practices and what's wholesome about them, what's necessary to preserve those things.
Well, if what you've heard today, everybody, has piqued your interest, then I strongly urge you to visit theamericanconservative.com. It's always worth your time, and you might not agree with everything there, but I don't agree with everything at any particular place. So it still makes you think. Dan is an astute editor, and he picks out good, talented people, and they cover interesting topics, so you can't ask for more than that. So, Dan McCarthy, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, that's it for the program for today. My thanks to Dan McCarthy. Make sure and check out theamericanconservative.com, which is your antidote against all the neocons, wicked neocons out there. Check out theamericanconservative.com. Tomorrow, we'll be talking to Eric Voorhees about Bitcoin, the future of Bitcoin following the shutdown of Silk Road. There have been more arrests announced just yesterday in that Silk Road matter. So we're going to talk to Eric Voorhees about that. How private is Bitcoin? How anonymous is it? Is this the beginning of the end, or rather, the end of the beginning? Whatever the heck that means. So join us for that tomorrow. Don't forget, Rollback. You'll get a free, autographed, personalized copy by joining libertyclassroom.com by tomorrow. That's it, everybody. Keep on subscribing on iTunes. You're filling me with happiness. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.